I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by our friends at Audvisor. I've told you about the app before, which is like a cross between podcasts and audiobooks. Simple 3-minute insights from numerous experts on all sorts of subjects. A few months back, we did an interview with a guy named Jim Bunch about designing environments for optimal performance and creativity. If you haven't heard about it, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's one of the best interviews of the entire year. And one of the things that he talked a lot about was designing environments. So if you download the Audvisor app to your phone and tweet or Instagram a picture of it with the hashtag unmistakable, we'll send you a free assessment of your 9 environments. It's amazing how revealing this assessment is and how much it can improve your life. You'll be blown away by just how much it reveals to you. Now, let's get into the episode. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, I speak with author, designer, filmmaker, and fire starter James Victoria, whose work has been exhibited at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City and is represented in permanent collections around the globe. James, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Srini, I am tickled pink to be here, and I love the name Unmistakable Creative. That is very groovy.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And, you know, I came across your story by way of, you know, numerous mutual guests who have tweeted things you've said. I've seen your work quoted in things that I absolutely love. I've seen, you know, read articles that you've written in 99U, and I thought, you know what, I've got to talk to this guy. There's got to be something here in this story that people absolutely love. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your journey, your story, your background, and how that has brought you to what you're up to in the world today?
Oh, hell, you're going to start with that. you know, the funny thing, Srini, is the last couple of years I've been telling everybody, you know, I am everyone's favorite artist. They just don't know it yet. I am on an interesting path right now, in that, one, I was kind of born to be a designer. I was born to be an artist. When I was a kid, I was wildly creative, like all kids. So Malcolm Gladwell has this thing he calls the 10,000 hours. Takes 10,000 hours to become a master in your craft. Mm-hmm. My 10,000 hours began when I was 5 years old. You know, I when I was a kid, my mother would take me shopping, and we would leave a department store, and she would look down, and I would be clutching a handful of tags that I had ripped off of all these, you know, various clothing pieces. And what I was doing at the time, I was curating, I was gathering the things that I visually responded to. I've just been lucky enough that I've stayed on this this path of mine. You know, I just wrote a new article for the 99U, and it's called Hey Weirdo. Mm-hmm. And it's about how difficult it is to stay on that path. You know, because the weirdness in us gets taught out of us or shamed out of us or embarrassed out of us or we give it away in order to fit in, you know. And in order to be an unmistakable creative as an adult, you know, you really kind of have to hold on to that. And I think that's one thing that I've been very good at my entire career is either to fail or be shepherded into, you know, doing what I love. And over the last couple of years, I've realized that I'm a pretty good graphic designer. Meaning I can get, I've had 2 shows at the Museum of Modern Art, and I'm in their permanent collection, which is awesome, but I've realized I'm a much better teacher. Mm-hmm. And after teaching at the School of Visual Arts for almost 20 years, I've stepped down from that, and now I'm using my words and my images to kind of help hungry, horny creatives who are in their, you know, mid-career, to help them have a career as rich as I have had. Mm. So I don't know if I'm really kind of answering your question of how I, you know, started in this thing, but this is kind of the path that I'm on, and it's a very exciting and very scary place to be.
Okay, so a lot of different things here, and I like to dig really deep, especially into early sort of childhood formative experiences. I love that you said that you were born to be an artist. I think that's a really sort of insightful observation, And one of the things that's interesting to me is this idea that the weirdness is kind of sucked out of us, and you have to hang on to it in order to stay an unmistakable creative. I'm interested in how we start to bring it back if it has been taught out of us, especially when we've gotten to this point in adult life when we have all these sort of expectations from the world around us.
Yeah, no, it's funny. You know, I remember, I got a favorite bar I go to, and it's kind of just like a locals bar, and you'll get like guys who work for the MTA, the subway, or you get like, working stiffs. Mm-hmm. These guys are so funny and so smart. And I'm always thinking, God damn, these guys would make amazing designers, amazing artists, amazing comedians or actors or writers if they had just, you know, if that spark hadn't been, you know, taught out of them or hadn't been scared out of them or had it been taught or shepherded, you know. You know, creativity is, you know, they talk about the new creative commerce or whatever. Creativity is in danger in this country. You know, it's not taught, it's not fostered. Public schools are more and more getting rid of music departments and art departments and anything that reeks of creative. So we can get those well-paying jobs that we're not made for. Mm-hmm. Am I answering your question?
Not entirely. I mean, I think there's more there. I mean, I guess, you know, you're right. It's what I'm curious about is how you get it back.
Yeah, no, it's funny. How you get it back. I think the hardest part is recognizing it or kind of like looking back. I had an assistant here who he worked with me for 4 years, brilliant guy. And after about a year and a half, he was able to kind of look back on his career, on a career that he thought was just kind of bouncing around from useless job to useless job. And he realized that he was actually in an odd way being shepherded, and he was picking up things along the way. Most of my students, at least in university, I tell all my students that, listen, if you've come to art school straight out of high school, you probably made a big mistake because you basically don't know jack shit, right? Most of my students, the better ones, have had some failure, uh-huh. You know, have had some other course of study or had some real life experience, because that's what helps you. That's what shepherds you and guides you into realizing, you know, at least it's like dating. It's like, well, I don't like those things, uh-huh. You know? You know, when I was getting out of high school, I didn't get accepted into the universities that I wanted. And the two careers that were presented to me were nursing and, working for the prison. It was a local prison. and I kind of had a moment of introspection and said, well, I don't feel like a nurse. I don't think I was made to be a prison guard. You know, there's got to be something else out there. So I was lucky enough to, you know, to find an apprenticeship at a tiny little design studio in my hometown. And then from there worked up to where I could put a portfolio together and, apply to art schools. So I needed to fail from other things while at the same time kind of paying attention to that tiny little spark that I was born with. And I think that's the hard part, is really kind of recognizing it in yourself. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're creative or you feel like you're a singer or a musician and any of these careers where people go, oh, well, you know, there's no money in it. Mm-hmm. Fuck the money. Oh my God. You know how many people have money and have the car and their house and they're so completely unsatisfied. I mean, you know, the car and the house, that's easy. You know, true happiness, true to be an unmistakable creative or even – and not even just to be a successful one. You know, I'm surrounded in a really nice community here in Brooklyn with photographers and illustrators and animators who – they're all just trying. They're all just completely happy, and they're just out fighting the good fight on a daily basis. You know, it's hard to kind of hold on to that creative spark in a country and in a world that, you know, only values the thickness of your wallet.
Let me ask you this. You know, I recently had an opportunity to go back to speak to my high school AP English teacher's class 20 years later.
Awesome.
And it was really cool because I'm now, you know, having a book come out with a publisher and all of that. And I thought, of all places, that was not the class that I ever expected to go back to when I was in high school. Reason being, I come from a culture, being Indian, that very much emphasizes sort of a linear achievement-oriented path. And I guess really the question for me, as you know, for you, as somebody who's been in our education system, and come out of it as the person you have, why do you think we have such an emphasis as a culture on safe, guaranteed, linear paths?
You know, the thing is, secondary education, college, you know, is really expensive. And I know as a teacher, even in, you know, art school or design school, you know, I had to tell all of my students, I said, listen, I am doing you a disservice. I am going to get you all hopped up on creativity, and then you're going to get out in the world, and it's not – this business is not inherently wildly creative and high-paying. But the school wants to make your parents happy, and the school wants to do you a service and get you to be able to pay your rent. You know, so in order to do that, you know, to a certain degree, we teach lower standards instead of, you know, higher standards. A lot of schools, especially schools outside of, you know, outside of like the big central hubs of creativity, like New York or L.A., they teach cowardice. They teach to the business, you know, and what I call an acceptable level of creativity. And that's a problem. That's a problem because we're teaching them just how to answer to a boss. You know, we're kind of what I mean. Even Bob Dylan said, 20 years of schooling and they put you on the day shift. Yes. You know, that's not a creative life.
No doubt. So how do you break that pattern if you happen to be a byproduct of this system that you've been indoctrinated into?
You know, you break that pattern in that you seek help. You seek mentors. You have to understand that are not in the majority. You know, you have to understand that. That it's going to be a long fight, but it won't be a sad fight. You know, it's hard because there isn't a train that goes there. It's a solitary path, and you've got to find your community. You got to find the people around you, and you know, I've got people who I mentor from, you know, from England and Japan and stuff, who write me, who are basically not in a creative community, and they need someone to talk to. So they, you know, we have Skype sessions where they, you know, where I kind of remind them of what's important. You know, that's the thing, is like, it's difficult if you don't have a community. And I'm extremely blessed because I have a community of hotheads and hooligans around me. And I have an amazing wife who is on the same path as I am. You know, that's a whole nother thing. If you want to have a life and a family and a wife and a dog and stuff, I mean, you have to make sure that that they're on the team as well. I mean, it's not good for people to go out and do it on your own, because it's really difficult that way. It's hard to be creative in your 20s, and it's hard to be creative in your 30s, and it's harder to be creative in your 40s, and you know, and as it goes along, you know, it becomes a difficult path. But it is also, like I said, we don't do it for the reward. We do it because we have to do it. And I think when we get to that point, I think then the reward follows you. You know, I always tell people, you know, you would dig this coming from the Indian culture. I make a number of references to the Bhagavad Gita, mm-hmm. you know, and in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a phrase that says, you are not entitled to the fruit of your labor. You're only entitled to the labor itself. And that means do the work. Don't seek reward. Do the work. And if you do the work, the reward will find you. But we don't do it for the reward.
It's funny because I said something similar in my book. I said, you know, art that rewards its creator long after the average person quits is admired but rarely encouraged.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's do this. I really want to hear about sort of your childhood and molding moments that have...
I'm trying to avoid it as much as possible.
Well, you know, you're about to learn that I don't settle for surface level answers. I'm like, okay, I need to dig deeper into everything here. I'm really interested actually in, you know, what kinds of parents did you have that would lead you down this sort of a path? And also the molding moments of everything in your life and career that have brought you to where you're at now.
Interesting. Okay. So here are the two biggest contributors and are my parents, and both of them are completely were completely ignorant of of their contribution. So let's start with my dad. So I was reared in a military household. My father flew over Vietnam during the Vietnam War, but in his travels he collected a lot of things. He collected bullfight posters from Barcelona and from Madrid, and he was spent time in Alaska and brought things back, and spent time in Bangkok, Thailand, and brought little toys and magazines back. So, and I lived in upstate New York, up near the Canadian border, where, and this was in the 60s, where you just didn't have access to these types of things. I mean, in the winter, if you wanted fruit, it was apples. Mm-hmm. It was before shit was being shipped all over the world, right? So my father would bring back all these cultural artifacts that were just beautiful pieces of, you know, they were magazines and they were swords and they were dishes, and he brought back chopsticks, and it was like, what do we do with these? You know, but they were beautifully made and they were handcrafted. And and I remember once one of the little toys he brought back from Bangkok had stopped working. So I opened it up and to change the batteries, and the batteries inside were beautiful. They had like script that I couldn't read, and they were black and yellow like a bumblebee. And I remember remarking at how beautiful they were. So my father was bringing back all these, artifacts from around the world that just really turned me on visually. And my parents also were amateur, they were antique hunters. So they were always searching for antiques. We had like old books and old postal telegraph clocks and all this kind of weird stuff that other people's houses didn't have, right? Mm-hmm. While at the same time, my mother worked we were in a university town, and my mother worked in the university library. And when I was 9 and 10 years old, I would get out of school and I'd walk the two blocks to the library. We didn't live in town. We lived outside of town. And I'd walk to the library after school and wait for her for about an hour and a half or 2 hours so she could drive me home when she got off of work. Right? So she knew I liked to draw. So what she would do to amuse me is she would go to the reference department and get a stack of picture books. But these picture books were collections of design history, collections of art history. And she would give me a piece of what was it called? Back then it was called onion skin paper or letter, you know, typing paper. And I would just pour through these books and redraw all the pictures in them. So I was getting this at 9 and 10 years old. I was getting this huge education in design and art. So my parents were a huge part of my design and art education, and they did it completely ignorantly.
So you had, you know, these really early molding moments, and I have asked this question a dozen times because I'm not satisfied with the answer I've gotten yet, maybe because there isn't one. Why do you think so many people miss those molding moments?
I think they're not presented as viable. They're just not things that people do. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a so one of my mentors who I was able to learn from and meet late in his life was this Polish designer named Henryk Tomaszewski, and Henryk is largely considered the father of the modern poster. He was born in 1914, and he lived. He lived, 90 years. And when he was a kid, he wanted to be a painter, right? And this was in Warsaw. And his parents wanted him to choose a more viable career as a musician. So even in a creative household, I mean, I didn't even grow up in a creative household, but even in a creative household, the parents didn't see what he wanted as viable, but they saw music as something that you could get paid for. So, I mean, it's like you don't, you know, if you enjoy playing with dolls, uh-huh. and you happen to be and making dresses for them, and you happen to live in Oklahoma and be a boy, you're pretty much screwed.
Yeah.
No one's going to present the career of fashion design to mm-hmm. you. No one's going to create present the career of stylist to you. You're pretty much screwed and ostracized. So it's just these careers are not seen as viable, which is interesting nowadays because, you know, now I see a lot of people who are doing things like showing the popular culture five different typefaces and asking them to name which face is which. So now, like, the average person knows the names of typefaces, you know, knows these people are becoming more conscious of these kind of secrets of design and marketing and advertising. So it'll be interesting to see if this has some kind of effect and, children are allowed to go into these fields, like to choose a career of advertising or to choose marketing or to choose graphic design. But you know, I the funny thing is at the School of Visual Arts, and a lot of the schools, advertising and marketing and graphic design are being put aside for game design, mm-hmm. you know, for app design. Which is directly correlated to the money you can make if you have an app out there and you sell it for a dollar and it goes wildfire, you know, as opposed if you have a gift for drawing letters. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it is just it's not presented as something that you know that one could make a living in. And hell, that's okay. You know, hell, I mean, we are not for everybody. We're just for the sexy people.
You know, one of the other things that's really interesting to me that you said is when people come to art school straight out of high school, they're not really ready. I get the sense that in a lot of ways, we're not really ready to make any major decisions about life when we are just out of high school. And I'm interested in hearing, you know, why you think that happens to be the case, what kinds of experiences we need to go through in order to, for lack of something less cliche or cheesy, find a calling?
You know, I think we have to jump through hoops. I think that's just the game. I mean, that's just how it works. I could write a book, Srini, about the failures that I've had. The number of times I've been told no, I shouldn't be a designer. The number of times I've had, you know, a ruler across my knuckles because I stepped outside of my bounds. Hell, even, you know, even now in my career. And I think those are just the obstacles. Mm-hmm. That's what it takes. You know, if you want to be an actor or you want to be a musician, I mean, there's a lot of failure involved. You don't just get out there and boom, you're a success. You know, most bands have been out busting their humps on the road, playing to clubs with three people in them for 10 years before they make it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them don't make it, but that's the game. That's just how you get good. You know, I mean, I had to bust my hump for years, and then even as a designer, even when I chose to move to New York and become a designer, and I had goals and plans, very very definitive goals and plans when I was when I was 19 and moved to New York, and I got a little bit of work going on, and I was making a couple thousand a pop for a book jacket, and I was doing a lot of book jackets, and then I woke up like 5 or 7 years down the road and I was like, oh wait, being a book jacket designer wasn't one of my goals. I got satisfied, you know, and I had to kind of stop and rethink my goals and get back on you know, my own little personal wagon. Mm-hmm. But I think failing at a lot of other things is good for us. It's just the process. That's how it works. You know, nothing should be handed to us. We have to work for these things.
So let's talk specifics. You get to New York at 19, and I am interested in the journey from that point to where you're at. You know, the failures, the successes, the things that have been the byproduct of all the things that you have gone through. Because I know that you're up to a whole bunch of things in the world now.
Yeah, no, I tell everybody, don't you know, what is it? What is that Jack Nicholson line? Don't be like me. Don't be like me. No, I did it the dumb way. So I graduated high school, did extremely well in high school because it was easy for me. Mm-hmm. But I didn't do well in getting into university. So I went to the university in my hometown, State University of New York. And after the first semester, I was asked to leave. Because I got like a 0.04 cum, right? Met this designer in this tiny little studio, a design studio. It was called Graphic Advertising, and they literally made menus for restaurants. You know, that was the level of creativity in the joint. But the guy was really sharp. And he had worked in agencies, and he kind of got me excited about graphic design. So I started applying to all the schools on the East Coast, and I got accepted to all the design schools on the East Coast. And I decided to go to the School of Visual Arts. So I was 19. I had $350 in my pocket and a bunch of albums under my arm, and I moved to New York. And I had the goals of being I wanted to be one of the best poster designers on the planet. I'm attending the School of Visual Arts, and somewhere in my second year, one of my instructors takes me aside, and I'm completely unhappy, completely unenthralled with the way the education was being presented to me. And this one of my instructors takes me aside, and he says, "Hey, listen, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, looking for the same job, and a lot of people who are going to be graduating here who are really talented." And he basically suggested I become a golf pro or a CPA or something. So I left school. I dropped out of the School of Visual Arts. And but I had one instructor, a book jacket designer, oddly enough. Being reared in a library, books seemed to be a natural for me. So I had one instructor. His name is Paul Bacon. Amazing guy. He did Joseph Heller's Catch 22. He did the book cover for Jaws that became the movie poster. He did all of Robert Ludlum's stuff. Amazing designer. And Bacon took me in as an intern, and right after literally 2 days after I dropped out of SVA, took me in as an intern. 3 weeks later, I put together a portfolio of like fake fake covers because I hadn't worked yet, but fake covers. I did the most important book to me at the time, which was George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London, which seemed to make the most sense. Got work right off the bat. I went out, saw the first art director. He gave me work, and then he became my major pimp for a number of years. And became a book jacket designer, and I just did a ton. Was working on 3 to 5 to 7 books at the same time, you know, always. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is at the time when I first started out, my book covers looked like Paul Bacon's book covers because I was coming from his studio. I was looking over his shoulder and saying, oh, that's what they look like, you know? And then at one point I was buying fancy suits. I'd bought my first motorcycle cash. I was getting cocky, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was looking around at my covers and looking around at, you know, Paul's stuff. And I was like, you know what? Wait a minute. I got my own sense of humor. I got my own way of seeing. I've got my own sense of size and proportion and color. And I started designing very bizarre, very different, theoretically very James Victoria mm-hmm. covers. And you know what happened? My clients hated them. Work dropped tremendously because people weren't interested in that. Because when they worked with me, they didn't know what to expect anymore. Mm-hmm. Previously, they could expect a book cover that looked like a damn book cover, you know? And what I had to do is that started me off on a completely new path where I had to search for smart, brave clients with money and people who would support the way I was seeing. Uh-huh. So I had added a whole nother level of difficulty to the game. But it also made me immensely happy to make something that was mine, that was recognizable as mine. And you know, what's funny is I've got there's a coffee table book of my work out. It's called Victoria or Who Died and Made You Boss. And in it, early on in the book, there are a bunch of these early book covers. And I really didn't want to put them in the book, but I had to put them in the book because they really show a young designer searching, a young designer struggling to figure out typography and to figure out color and to figure out, can I put my own handwriting? Can I be so brave as to put my own handwriting on the cover? It's kind of interesting to look back at the work and see the process that I was trying to go through.
Let's take a quick break. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at Oddvisor. It's an app that's like Pandora for business advice. It's completely free and it's available on Android and iPhone. You spell it Audvisor. And remember to download it and tweet or Instagram a picture of the app on your phone, and we'll send you a free assessment of your 9 environments from former podcast guest Jim Bunch. Okay, are you sitting down? I'm about to tell you about Aspiration, a different kind of financial firm. Their idea is pretty simple. Take everything you don't like about investing and do the opposite. Traditional Wall Street firms work mostly for millionaires. At Aspiration, their investment strategies are built for the middle class. Signing up takes as little as $500 and 5 minutes of your time. You choose the fee you pay them, even if that's zero. They don't make a cent other than what you decide they deserve. That means you know they're committed to working for you. And they're the most charitable financial firm in America. They donate 10 cents of every dollar their company makes to microloans for struggling Americans working to build a better life. Fox Business News says Aspiration is shaking things up for Wall Street, and I think we can all agree that industry definitely needs some shaking up. So check them out and sign up at aspiration.com/creative. Their motto is do well and do good. And isn't it time a financial firm was built on helping us do a little more of both? Again, that's aspiration.com/creative. Past performance is not indicative of future returns. There's no guarantee that any investment product will achieve its objectives, generate profits, or avoid losses. Investing involves risk of loss, and alternative investments may not be suitable for everyone. Before investing, consider your investment objectives. Now, back to the show. So let me ask you this. One of the things that's always interesting to me, especially because you mentioned this idea of work that was yours and we know it came from you. I mean, to me, that's effectively the definition of unmistakable. Nobody else could have done this. I'm interested in how you take the artistic inputs and the artistic influences from your life and start to develop your own style as an artist and creative, and, you know, whatever form your art happens to take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So hopefully, I'll just say it in like the general sense, not my own particular story, but so what happens is, hopefully, along the way, you will start to get a sense of what people are responding to in your work. Mm-hmm. And in my work, it was a sense of – what they responded to was a sense of being a little off to the left. You know? I wasn't following the rules per se when I – in my work. Everything had a little – it was always kind of – off. There was a macabre sense of humor, or there was a different way of hopefully seeing things, or there was some subtle in jokes, and those were things that just made me happy. And it's something that I call, in the particular lies the universal, and it's something that we work very hard to teach now. Mm-hmm. And that says, listen, your way of seeing, your particular sense of humor, your sex appeal, your sense of poetry or drama, that's important. Put it in the work. And the more honest and the more authentic you can be about who you are and putting it into the work, the larger, the more meaning it's going to have for your audience. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you may not have you can't speak to everybody. You know, advertising, the biggest problem with advertising is they want to freaking talk to everybody at once, and it's patently impossible. You can't – if you appeal to everybody, then you appeal to nobody. Mm-hmm. Because it's like advertising tries to be like oatmeal. Well, everybody likes oatmeal. Well, no, not everybody likes oatmeal. You know, you can't just make something that appeals to everybody. What you can do is make work that makes you happy. Mm-hmm. Make work that blows your own skirt up. Because dollars to donuts, I bet there's a huge group of people, and those are called your audience, that will get excited by it. It's in the particular lies the universal. The more authentic I can be about being James Victory, the more excited people get about my work. Or my words. You know, Srini, in your new book, the more honest you are about this idea of writing 1,000 words a day, mm-hmm. the larger your audience is going to be. The more authentic these people are going to be, the more true they're going to be to you. Mm. And again, you're not for everybody. You're only for the sexy people.
I love that. You know, it's funny because as you're saying that, I can't help but think about one of our survey respondents who went, you know, obviously took the time to critique me and said, I'm not really in love with, you know, Srini's interview style. And then they listed all the other interviewers that they wished I sounded like.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought,
and you should, and yeah. That's awesome.
And I thought, well, then why are you listening to us? You should just go listen to those other people.
Yeah. You know, Srini, I think you should be more like Charlie Rose. You know? But there's already a Charlie Rose. Don't freaking be a Charlie Rose. It's hilarious. You know, it's funny. I always tell this story. Like, say you've got you open up a tiny little borscht restaurant. Uh-huh. Because your grandma, your Uma, made the best borscht in the world, and so you've got a tiny little restaurant with like just like 5 tables, right? And all these people are coming and like, oh my god, this is the best borscht. It reminds me of my grandma, and blah 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 blah. After a while, people are going to get comfortable, and they're going to start saying, you know what my grandmother used to? She used to put a lot of sour cream. Oh yeah, my grandma used to use hot sauce. Yeah. So you start paying attention to all this stuff, and after a while, you're not doing anything authentic anymore. You're taking a survey. You're fulfilling a survey, uh-huh. And you're making crap. You're making crap that you're trying to appeal to everybody, and because of that, you're not making yourself happy anymore, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about this idea of honesty and, you know, rawness and realness.
Only if I can lie. Yeah.
Oh. You know, this really interests me because I – have really wrestled with this balance of how honest should you be and how do you know you've gone too far? And like, it's the question of, okay, this is really vulnerable. It's raw, it's authentic, but maybe it should have been contained to your therapist office, not for your audience. And how you find that balance without compromising the integrity of what you do.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah, sharing. What's funny for me, Srini, is so we have – I've got this video project, a weekly video called Burning Questions that we put out on YouTube every week. And the times that people respond the most vehemently and the most excited are the times when I'm literally when I'm really struggling with a personal decision or really being vulnerable, mm-hmm. Almost to the point where I don't think I should say this, you know, that's when people actually most respond. I don't know if I've crossed that I'm very conscious of that border that you're talking about, uh-huh. You know, that line. But I think the closer you can get to that line, the more interesting it is. Mm. Meaning, so here's a visual for you. I had this designer pal of mine come into my class once, and he wanted to describe to the students that line. Right, so he walks into the class and he's drinking a cup of coffee off the street, right? One of those paper cups. He's got a full cup of coffee, and he spends about 2 minutes balancing it on the edge of the desk, like just so he sheepishly lets his hand off of it, and it is teetering, you know, it is like ready to go smash on the floor, but it's not. It's just like teetering on the edge of the desk. And everybody is just riveted, staring at this cup. And he said, that's what I do for a living. Meaning it should have that tension. It should be at that line all the time. That's an interesting place to be. You know, I'm a fan of comedians and stand-up mm-hmm. comedy. And what's really fascinating with comedians is there is an extremely fine line between them being hilarious and them being idiots.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? There's a really – I think that's the best scenario that I can think of is stand-up comedy, when some guy's up there being completely raw about himself or his girlfriend or his – you know, like what's his name? Louis C.K. He's uh-huh. great at it. He talks about his sweaty balls, and it's hilarious. It's not embarrassing. Mm. You're like, oh my God, I'm there. Dude, I'm totally there. You know? It's because, again, it goes back to the in the particular lies the universal. But it's a really fine line, and it can be very you know, you can live and die by it. Mm. So I don't know where it lies. And I'm getting close to it because I'm doing much more writing and filming these days and putting opinions out more than kind of choosing colors and choosing type. You know, I'm much more of a teacher these days than a graphic designer. So I think that line is much more important to me, is much more prescient. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you one more thing about this.
Of course.
One of the things that I keep finding, and maybe it's only because I'm asking about it, is a lot of periods of real darkness, almost even anxiety, depression, you know, things that are very, very difficult for people, with a lot of guests here on the show. And I'm curious if you've had any moments like that in your career and how you've pulled out.
Hold on. Let me get my wife for you.
It just, the reason I brought it up is it seems more and more I am seeing a willingness from people to talk about it. Like Tim Ferriss wrote a post about suicide on his blog. And then I noticed somebody else followed suit, and I noticed more and more people are following suit. And I'm kind of thinking, wow, wait a minute. These are our heroes and our role models, the people we have placed on pedestals. They start to become human all of a sudden. And I'm just curious about your perspectives on all of this.
Oh, no. You know, Well, if Tim Ferriss did it, then I have to do it now. Shit. you know, people are dying. You know, even if I'm let's say I'm just talking about marketing and advertising. Mm-hmm. People want someone out there to tell the truth. People will follow an authentic voice. You know, even if you're selling shit, people will follow you. You know, my wife Laura pointed out the other day, Patagonia did a full page ad for one of their jackets. And she said they said don't buy this coat. And they gave all the reasons, and they gave like how much things cost and what the labor was and blah blah. The freaking coat sold like hotcakes. You know, they were being completely honest. They said don't buy this coat, and we loved it because they were being honest. You know, even in marketing and advertising, it works. And I don't mean like it works as in like, hey, that's a good trick, but people want to follow an authentic, true voice. They mm-hmm. they don't want you to be aloof and untouchable. They mm-hmm. want to know that, you know, that you're a human being. This is important because quite frankly, there aren't enough human beings out there or enough people being that completely honest. It's powerful and moving. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, I'm gonna make up some awesome story about suicide. That'd be groovy. Actually, for me, it wouldn't be suicide. For me, it would be I was gonna kill this guy. I kill other people. I kill other people first.
Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit, and let's talk about teaching. You know, I think in some form or another, every one of us who is creating is teaching, and I'm really interested in how the students you have taught have influenced the way that you create now.
Oh man, gee whiz! There's this line. There's this thing that that says teaching is if you do it well, teaching is a very selfish occupation. I've always learned so much more from my students than I feel that I've given them, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's awesome. That means you're onto something. Mm-hmm. You know, that means you're hitting a chord and you're sharing well. I don't know if that's English. Was that English? Was I speaking English there for a second? No, I think that's the job. Is if you do it well, it's a selfish occupation.
Wow.
What was your question?
No, I think you answered it. So I remember what it was that got me really interested in your story, and I for some reason can't get this line out of my head. It was in a Medium essay that you wrote where you said, "Here lies the guy's name. He would have done something creative, but he had to pay the rent." I don't know if you remember that.
Oh yeah.
And you got a lot of flack from it. I remember there was a lot of pissed off comments.
Pussies. I got flack from cowards. That's the only flack I ever get is from people who are afraid of their own lives. It's crazy.
The question that brings up for me is one that I've been trying to think, you know, and as we've been having this whole conversation, I'm curious if you had sort of a central ethos or something that connects all of your work together, sort of a defining principle, what would you say that is?
You know, Srini, excellent question. I remember a bunch of years ago, and this was before I was teaching. This was before I was putting thoughts out and before I was writing these thoughts down and sharing and before Instagram and Twitter and all that. I was at an exhibition in Switzerland, a poster exhibition in Switzerland a number of years ago. Jeez, I don't know, 15 or more years ago. And The Swiss audience are very savvy, very sharp about posters and graphic design. And I had a designer come up to me after I did a little talk, and a designer come up to me after and said, if you laid out all of, you know, he's talking to me, he says, if you laid out all of your posters, it would be a portrait of you. Which I thought was extremely interesting because even as a graphic designers, my posters, people don't talk about what they look like. Mm-hmm. They talk about what they say. They talk about the ideas that we try to embed in these things. So having an opinion for me has always been an extremely important part of being a designer, and now trying to be a teacher or a leader of sorts.
Do you think that central ethos that reveals itself as a part of a body of work is something that only happens as you progress, or it's only something that can be uncovered, or is it something that you know right from the start?
Oh, I think quite frankly, Srini, I think it's something that you find in retrospect.
I would say so too. That's what I figured.
I think it's something that, you know, I mean, to quote, Letters to a Young Poet, you know, Rilke. I think it's like you have to live the questions. And if you do a good job living the questions, you're going to wake up someday and look back and see that you've lived your way into the answer. So I think it's something that, like, you know, I when that guy in Switzerland said, you know, these posters look like they're a portrait of you, that was huge to me. Mm-hmm. That was huge to me. I was like, oh, damn. And then even before that, when I was living in New York and going to school, trying to pay my way through the School of Visual Arts, and I had a day job that eventually became my full-time job. But I was like working in a sporting goods store. I was working in a ski shop, actually, selling skis and boots and stuff. My whole life, I draw voraciously. I draw all the time, and I used to. They had these like stacks of Post-it notes, you know, with the ski shop's logo on them and stuff. And I used to always just make these goofy little drawings on these Post-it notes, and then just stick them around, just leave them as like little Easter eggs for people. And people who've worked over the years in the ski shop, if you went and visited any one of them, they would somewhere in their house have a little teeny little frame, and in it would be a Post-it note of mine. And I realized that people were really responding to these little gifts, these little jokes I was making, these little silly little drawings. And that was something else that I was very lucky to kind of pay attention to, be privileged to early on, you know. And even now when I do work, or when I, you know, Instagram and Twitter are proving grounds for me. You know, we put out these crazy ideas, and it's really important that I pay attention to how people respond to them. I love that. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, real time grading on my essay. Mm.
Let's talk briefly about gifts, because I think my Google search right before we hopped on here revealed an article you wrote on gifts, and that was what I shared on Facebook. Let's talk about that and the whole idea of approaching our work as if it's a gift that we're giving.
Yeah. So the way it works is this. So I talked earlier about this kind of the idea of in the particular. Mm-hmm. Like in the particular lies the universal. Like the more authentic you can be about putting – understanding who you are and putting it in the work – the next step is what happens is if you truly are being authentic and putting it in your work, what you're doing is you're not working for a paycheck anymore. You're not working to make a boss or a client happy. You're working to make yourself happy. And in doing so, you are actually giving what you're putting out in the world, what you're giving is a piece of yourself. You know, and then when you get to that point, then your work is a gift. And so it applies to me as a designer. So the better I can be at crafting these ideas and putting them in some beautiful or ugly form. I don't care. I don't really discern between beautiful or ugly. And the more honest I can be, people really, really respond to that. And my work becomes a gift. Mm-hmm. And even to put it in a more pedestrian way. So let's take a bus driver. Let me go backwards and talk about design and advertising. So in design and advertising, we're given you get an email or you get a sheet of paper that says, here's what you got to do. Here's what we want from you. Here's what we're going to give you $45 to do. And that's the objective. That it becomes the objective. Okay, I got to satisfy this objective to get that $45. And most people are capable of that. Mm-hmm. They can finish the job and get $45. But most people are ignorant of the subjective. So the objective is sell these socks, get butts in the theater, you know, that kind of thing. The subjective is how you do it. And how you do it is, do you do it with sex appeal? Do you do it with poetry? Do you do it with drama? Do you do it with humor? Do you do it with a macabre sense of humor? So most people are capable of getting, you know, filling the first part, but they don't do the second part very well. So now to take it like back, like I was saying before, a pedestrian level, you take a bus driver. His objective is to get the bus to certain points of the route at certain times, right? That's his objective. That's him fulfilling his duty. Mm-hmm. Now, if you had a bus driver who was conscious of the subjective of how he did it, you know, I've heard stories of bus drivers who, with a smile, change people's day. With a hi, how do you do? You know, this is amazing. There used to be the subway driver. He was on the A line in New York. Right? And if you were on the A line at the right time of day, this guy's driving the train and the train pulls into like 59th Street Station, right? And this guy will come on and go, 59th Street Station, next stop, 72nd Street, home of Zabar's and the Museum of, you know, the guy was hilarious. He was giving his objective. He was telling you what the next stop was, telling you the highlights of the next stop, but it was wonderful. He was like a carnival barker. And everybody, you'd look around the train, everybody's like looking around and smiling at each other going, oh, this guy's awesome, right? His work was a gift. Mm-hmm. It's not that hard. Just give a shit. just care about what you do. I can imagine, and I can imagine a bus driver who hates his job. Well, that guy should actually go find some job that makes him happy. Uh-huh. Go find his gift.
Okay, so that makes a perfect transition for two final questions. Earlier, very early in our conversation, you mentioned a period of introspection. And
the suicide years, yes.
I myself have been very fortunate in that surfing has always been this thing that's given me an opportunity for introspection. And what I'm interested in is how you find what you call the tiny sparks in our moments of introspection.
Yeah.
Yeah. No surface level questions.
What was that? The second of those two questions.
Oh, that's going to be even worse.
Shazbot. You know, I think those, to use that term, those tiny sparks. I think they're reoccurring. I think they're these, you know, tiny little angels that constantly nudge you. This little creeping idea that, you know, maybe you should do this thing. You know, the surfing thing I get because I surf. I'm not a surfer. Uh-huh. I surf. So the difference is, if the weather changes, a surfer goes. Mm-hmm. I surf. It means like, if I've got work to do, I'm like, anyway. So, but I understand the reference, and it's because you have time alone, time to think. Uh-huh. Other people have meditation. I'm a long distance runner, so when I go on a run, like if I'm stuck, if I'm like mentally constipated here in the studio, I'll just put my sneakers on and go. And about like a mile into it, I'm like, oh shit, oh no, oh, all these ideas start coming to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just it's seeking the muse. That's what it is. It's seeking the muse. It's an opportunity to get out of your daily routine. You know, most people, they get to work and they sit at a desk and kind of wait to bleed from the forehead. You know, wait for ideas, and it's a really tough way to work. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I think it's really important to seek the muse, to get outside of your routine, and allow, you know, the gods to whisper in your ear. And that's that's where the interesting stuff happens. You know, we get a lot of questions of people who are mid-career and kind of stuck in their 401k and their multi-level couch or whatever. I don't know, their big TV and their couch with their ass divot. And I have to basically tell them, listen, you gotta go on a walkabout, man. You gotta get out of your routine and go really kind of spend some time asking yourself some difficult questions. Mm-hmm. So I think seeking the muse is the way to kind of allow that spark to turn into an ember, you know. And then it's just a tiny ember, and now what do you got to do?
Right. Wow. This has been incredible. So I am going to.
I told you, man. I told you it was going to be good.
Oh, we got good stuff. I expected nothing less. If you didn't deliver, I was going to be really pissed off.
Damn, are you just like wasting your time talking to sad sack Tim Ferriss?
So you've had sort of this iconic creative career, and you've seen all sorts of artists, people who are timeless and have done really amazing work, and you yourself have. So what do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think they're paying attention to who they are, and there's just a shit ton of bravery and courage that statement implies. Mm. I think it's extremely hard to maintain that level of honesty through a career and not get swayed by popular opinion or the money, but I think the unmistakable creative you're talking about is someone who, you know, someone who's holding on, someone who's carrying the flame, man, right?
Yeah.
And that there, like I said, there's just a whole truckload of courage and bravery that entails. You know, and I've got an 18-year-old son who's graduating high school, and he's got a little. We got a little graduation party coming up, and you know, I have to write a little kind of toast, and that's what I'm going to talk about. I hope he has the courage and bravery to continue being who he is right now, because who he is right now is really great.
Wow. Well, James, like I said, this. It was amazing, as I expected it would be. And I can't thank you enough for
taking
the time
fun, right?
To join us. This is, like I said, this is one of those really eye-opening conversations that I think is going to force people to think, which are my favorite kinds of conversations.
Oh, man. I just did a workshop recently in Miami, and I got really great comments, but one of the comments was somebody was like, oh my God, James Victoria forced me to go places I didn't want to.
Well, hopefully you will do that for our listeners. Again, this has been absolutely phenomenal.
Thanks for your help, dude. Thanks for the great questions too.
My pleasure. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.